Guten Morgen.
Hello.
Hallo.
We're back.
Bitte.
How are we doing?
Very well, Will. How are you?
I'm very well. Very, very well indeed.
I forgot to say, welcome to Down Not Out, a yes. podcast about depression and anxiety with me, Paddy.
And me, Will.
Hallo.
Hi.
How Willkommen.
Was that Swedish?
No, the whole lot was German.
The whole lot was German.
Yeah.
My German Flawless. Knowledge is average to poor. I'm going to say it's more poor than average.
Out of 10, it wouldn't... Would it be 9?
It would, if you mean no, then yeah, that's what it would be. That's pretty much the only word I know.
Cool. So, Will, how's it going? What's been up? What have you been up to?
This past weekend, I went to Pride in London, my first time at Pride.
Mm, everyone remembers their first time.
Everyone remembers their first Pride, so I'm told, and I'll certainly never forget this one. I would call it life affirming. It was a joyous occasion.
Joyous occasion.
A lot of joy, a lot of people having a good old time. Colourful music, floats. Everybody just letting loose.
Good vibes, dare I say it.
Good vibes is exactly the term I would use.
Cool.
It's my friend's birthday, and she loves Pride. She's a straight woman, but she loves it as a sort of. You know, a political statement it's a good street party.
Good time
as well.
Party, yeah.
It's a good
sure.
party. So yeah, we were there doing that, and it's something that I definitely consider going to on a yearly basis now. It's fantastic, and like I think I mentioned to you previously, it's as a political statement, it seems quite prescient this year as well, in the wake of a couple of things that have been going on in the UK or incidents that have happened. That may sort of cast doubt on the certainty of
like progress and
progress in gay rights. So it felt like a real moment of defiance, albeit one that was covered in glitter and dancing around. But that's defiance can be whatever you want. Isn't
it? I mean that I think that's probably quite succinct and apt way of describing the Pride movement generally would be kind of glittery defiance.
Yeah,
I think,
absolutely, and. Yeah, I got really into it. I turned up just wearing my usual outfit of black jeans and black t-shirt.
What a cool man.
What a cool man.
He's wearing that now, by the way.
Wearing that now. Different ones, though. Different ones. I've got like six of each.
Show off.
Yeah. So I said, I can't be going into Pride looking like this. I look like I'm undercover. I don't know.
Or just a plain clothes hipster.
Plain clothes hipster. So I thought I need to get a ridiculously overpriced Pride flag. So I bought one of those for it was 15 quid for two. So my friend Georgie got one as well. And I tied it around my neck like a cape.
Good man.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. Well, that sounds very good.
It was lovely, mate.
I still have never been, which is quite embarrassing and quite sad, but I will go.
I'm definitely going next year, so you should come along.
Cool.
Should come along. What have you been up to, Paddy? Have you been anywhere interesting?
I love that. That is obviously we've discussed what we're going to talk about next.
I'm just numb.
But it now just sounds so unnatural. Is there anywhere interesting you've been? Oh, well, you know what? Just by chance, yes, I went to the Outer Hebrides last week.
Not the inner one, the outer one. And
that's actually true. I don't actually know the difference. I went to the Hebrides.
The Hebrides. But as the Outer Hebrides even further from Scotland in terms of the mainland?
I'm now really, really in sort of hashtag murky territory.
Sounds more extreme than the Inner Hebrides.
Yeah, that's why I said it. It just sounds sort of more adventurous. Talking of adventure, I nearly got stuck up a mountain.
Yeah. How did that happen to you?
Well, I was with a friend and we decided to scale not particularly impressive looking mountain, but as is the case with mountains, they're often more impressive and challenging than they appear at first. And we got to the top, very sort of jolly, very like not particularly sort of challenging, but a good feeling of sort of camaraderie, and got to the top and all very good. And then we were coming down and my mate says, I think we should probably take a separate route down. And like a different route to the one we'd taken up.
No.
Which was a terrible idea, and I made it very clear, just so I can, just for the record, that it was a terrible idea, and we still did it, and we went down. It took us about an hour to get down. We got down on the other side of the mountain and realised that we were just entirely surrounded by water and there was no way of getting off the mountain, at which point it was about 8:30 or so, and we then realised that we had to climb back up the mountain as it was getting dark. I had very nearly, I was about a couple of minutes away from writing a message to my brothers and potentially some other friends as well, saying, "Don't panic, but my phone is about to run out of battery and I'm stuck up a mountain. Here's my pin location. If you don't hear from me in 3 hours, please call emergency rescue. I'm one of those knobs who's going to end up on the news." Which is kind of like, it's quite lighthearted when you look back on it, but at the time it was fucking scary.
Yeah.
And really, really stupid. And I have forgiven my friend.
That's big of you.
Yeah.
I would still be making him squirm.
He did, the question he did ask when we were back off the mountain, when we were in the car, is he said, "Would you have forgiven me if you had died?"
It's a good question.
I would argue the exact opposite. I thought it was a terrible question. Anyway, I mean, I'm here now.
I mean, if we want to go into theology, which I'm sure is not where you were going, some people would argue that you do have the ability to forgive after you die.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we won't go there. I would say no. Don't forgive him, regardless.
Good stuff. So anyway, I've had a nice time to the Hebrides, which was actually amazing and stunningly beautiful.
Mm.
And when he told me, it was like, it takes a day to get there
to, from London to the Antarctica.
And I guess to slightly change the topic but go back to something that you were talking about earlier, in terms of going to Pride, something that has been interesting the past few weeks, the Women's World Cup.
Very interesting.
Major congrats to Team USA.
Yeah. I believe that we will win.
Is the worst chant ever made.
I mean, I think second to the one where they say, "We all eat barbecue" at the end of it.
What, sing it?
I mean, it's, I think it might be the Seattle Timbers or something like that. And it's something like, okay, I only know one bit of it, and it goes, "We all eat barbecue, we're gonna score three more than you." And there's some guy in the crowd as well who's like got like a fake chainsaw, and he's like, because there's apparently a lot of lumberjacks around the parts where the team's from. There's a video on Facebook somewhere, MLS chants compilations, and if you want to feel better than people, then go and watch it.
I will be going to watch it. Well, fans aside, or perhaps that's unfair, those two songs aside, US ballers.
The best thing about American soccer is the women's team, by some distance.
Yeah. It's a shame that you felt the need to use their word.
Oh yeah. I feel like it's...
What did you think I was going to say then?
I'm not sure.
You were really, really disappointed.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought...
You thought I was going to go in for some classic old school Eccles misogyny, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
I only do that off mic.
Yeah.
So what was cool about... Well, many things cool about it. One, they're an absolutely epic team and have totally dominated. Another, I had a huge amount of money on them to win it. But the main
point,
I do not endorse gambling.
Yeah.
The main thing that, well, no, what a thing that I read about yesterday, which is really cool. Are you laughing?
I was just laughing, saying the main thing, and I was like,
gets to the point.
Yeah, no, it's just like, it's a big thing, but yeah.
Okay, it's not the main thing. It's not the main thing. The main thing is they won.
It's the main, yeah, I was going to say that. I'm not sure they'd be like, the main thing here is that.
Yeah, that's
but
so true.
It's certainly an important
thing. It's an interesting thing.
Especially considering
what is the thing?
What is the thing? Well, good for building up to it. Especially considering the state, I think, in America as well.
Wore I can't even think of a joke. So the thing that we were going to talk about was that 41 of the players out there were openly gay and bisexual.
We're openly out there.
41 of the players out there were openly out there.
Yeah. And I think it was a fair few on the US team as well. I can name at least one. That sounds really bad, but I'm not the well versed in the American.
Yeah,
team.
But I mean,
so if I can name one,
that doesn't
more.
Mean that. No, it doesn't. It means
Why
you
not?
Can name one.
Why does it not mean there's more?
Because you can name one, and therefore it means there's definitely one.
Okay, fine.
And also,
who do you think it is that I can name? It's gonna be. It's pretty obvious.
Megan Rapinoe.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Well done. What a guy. So 41, and how many in the men's competition were openly gay or bisexual?
Zero.
Zero. And how many? No. I'm not gonna make a joke there. So
how many Premier League footballers? I'll save you the time. It's zero.
Yeah. Championship.
Zero.
League One.
Zero.
League Two.
Hundreds of them. League Two is just a wash of them.
They're all gay.
No, they're not. Again, it's probably
they're
zero.
Not, they're not. So that is, yeah. I mean, it just shows. What does it show?
I mean, I don't know what it shows. I really don't. I mean, it shows that, I guess, women's soccer is a more accepting place of homosexuality than men's.
I kind of feel though that this is about machismo or machismo, whichever is the correct way of saying that word, because this is about sort of men and women, you know, in female sports across the board. It's always been, I don't know, I'm not a woman, but I feel that it's always been fairly accepting of homosexuality.
Most definitely more so than male sport, because there's this thing of machismo and homosexual men are
given a, you've gone for a third pronunciation there.
What went
for machismo.
What is it, machismo or
well no it's a fourth.
what was the first,
should we use another word?
I don't know another word.
No, okay, we need to now avoid it.
Toxic masculinity.
Yeah, it's a bit cringe. Why did you just put some gum in your mouth whilst recording a podcast?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a terrible idea.
Yeah. So I think the main reason is that male sports have a real emphasis on toughness. And for what...
Yeah, but so do women's sports.
It's a different sort of toughness. As in, they have the same toughness in terms of like physical toughness, like sporting toughness. But men have like a sort of performative toughness that is linked to...
But that's the key point you're talking about there as well. This idea that toughness and homosexuality are kind of separate.
They're not.
But you've landed on the key point, because if it is about toughness, you know, most gay people I know are fuck of a lot tougher than a lot of straight people I know.
No, absolutely.
But, and I'm not saying that you're saying that, but it's so interesting, isn't it? This idea that what came to your head was toughness, and the idea that therefore that would equate to homophobia or to not being comfortable to come out, because the natural kind of prejudice is that homosexuality is linked to weakness, maybe.
I think,
or lack of toughness, or lack of masculinity.
I think what it is, and again, I'm speaking from how I think things are perceived, not how I think or feel.
Sure, mate.
it's gay men are, I say, in general, perceived to be more effeminate than straight men.
Yeah.
And again,
that's true.
And again, a sort of prehistoric view is that women are not as tough as men.
Yeah.
So then, gay men are considered to be similar to women in that regard.
Yeah.
And then,
No, you're right. You're right. And I guess there's just a long way to go. But it is interesting, isn't it?
And I guess then in the, if you switch that round with women, gay women are seen as stereotypically to be more masculine.
Yeah, true, yeah.
So they're seen almost to be more fitting into the sporting stereotype than a straight woman.
Yeah.
So I think that would help explain that as well.
No, it's true. And I guess controversial statement warning. You know, it goes without saying that a lot of these, you know, a lot of statements about sexuality, a lot of generalizations about sexuality, do come from like a place of truth. But the key is that it's just like, it's their generalizations, and that's what we need to get over.
It's that you don't.
And many gay men would feel no shame in saying that they are quite effeminate.
Exactly, and they shouldn't feel shame for saying that at all.
But equally, that's not true across the board, and that actually doesn't equate to lack of toughness, and so on and so forth.
Exactly. Well, I think the guest we have on today, for example, I would describe him, and I'm sure he'd describe himself as quite effeminate, but one of the toughest people I've ever met.
Yeah.
You know,
and a beast in the gym.
A beast in the gym. Yeah. Exactly.
Cool. Well, that sets us up quite nicely.
It really does. Yeah.
So here is our conversation with James. I hope that you guys enjoy it very much. Great. Okay. So today we are here with James. Hello, James.
Good morning.
thank you very much for coming in today. I'm just going to give to the listener a little bit of background, and also I want to do this whilst James is sat here, so he knows how appreciative and how much I respect what he does as a gym instructor. So, James, I started going to the gym about a year or so ago, and I despise the gym. I have no time for the gym as a general rule. It's never been anything that I've done. And I started going to a few different classes, and your classes in particular gave me an entire shift of perspective with regards to going to the gym. And there was this just amazing buzz. I would turn up to these classes and there'll be loads of people there of all different shapes and sizes. And you would turn up and the music would be pumping. You'd be bouncing around, having some sort of banter with different people about X and Y and partying and this and that. And I just felt like, I don't know, I knew that what I was about to do for the next 45 minutes was put my body under an unnatural amount of stress and strain. But I wasn't dreading it, because there was just this energy in the room. And then we would kick off. The music was always superb. The energy in the room was superb. And I pushed myself to levels that I don't really ever manage to outside of those classes. And the reason that I did, quite simply, was down to you. Because you, as a leader, as an instructor, created this setting that made me want to push myself and want to challenge myself and really feel that I was like gaining something whilst I was doing it. And that's a really difficult thing to achieve. And I've been to a number of other classes and very few of the instructors managed to do that. And I remember on your last class, when we turned up and you said that this was your last class and you were leaving, I was a bit like, sorry, what? and I remember at the end of that class, I was broken. I could sort of barely lift my arm in the air, and the lights went off, and there was some cheesy tune playing, and you said this. You told us how much this class meant to you, and there was this mutual feeling of respect, and I was just like, this is awesome. And then the reason I asked you to come on was actually something that you said in that kind of warm down session, which was about how you had overcome problems with drugs in the past, and that this wasn't actually about exercise for you, but this was about how much like you challenge yourself and how much pleasure you got from coaching people and seeing them challenge each other. So I guess I want to say thank you. I'm delighted that you're here. And can you just explain, I guess, a bit about what you were talking about in terms of that challenge and overcoming those issues you had in the past?
Wow. Waking me well up. Yeah. That was very sweet. And also very surreal to be sitting so close to you, receiving that such feedback and feeling very shy and very... get very quite fidgety, but also being very aware that I can't really fidget because it's going to be picked up in the mic. So I have to sit rather still. Thank you, firstly, for that kind feedback. It just makes, I can't really describe the feeling when I hear things like that. It just, that's purpose for me, that's purpose in my life, and that reminds me why I'm on the path I am and why the path that I was once on was never the path for me. So that is a grounding for me, that's an anchor for me, and that gives me more than I could even explain to you in words. So I'm going to put that in my pocket for later. Thank you. So, yeah, I guess a good place to start with it is I've always been a bit of a party boy. I like drugs. I'm going to put it out there. You know, and I'm very confident to say that now. And I used to have a tick and a stutter, and I guess I'll talk about that a bit later on when we get to it. It's taken me a lot to be able to say that quite confidently as well, and to remove the power from that word. So always a bit of a party boy, and I did it because I never really understood my emotional composition as a young gay man, or just as a gay man in general, or not even to do with my sexuality, just with being James, you know, just as a person. And I was very easily influenced, and I've basically fell in love with a guy, it was a very quite abusive, not necessarily physical, but emotionally. And he was the sweetest man I've ever met, and he had the most beautiful heart, and he was just on the wrong path as well. And then when two people are on the wrong path, or one's easily led, I kind of fell into a really dark place with drugs. And it took a long time for me to grow out of it. And my classes, and in particular certain classes and people along my journey, helped me climb out of that. And that particular class for me, and we were talking about it earlier, that the people that came to the class for me were just such real people. You know, they were real, they were honest, they were authentic, which is a really key word that I kind of use to describe things. And it just, that energy connection, that stream that just went between me and them and you, it just, yeah, it done so much for me. And that was my rehabilitation, really. My rehab was those classes. And I said it to my boss at Gymbox. She knows that. I was like, before I took the role as master trainer, I wasn't in a very good place. And it very much saved my life. And I probably wouldn't be here without having that energy and that love.
Brilliant. Thanks so much. So just to take us all the way back now, because I guess you've explained the fundamentals, which is an abusive relationship, and then using the exercise and gym classes to kind of turn that life around. And we'll look at that in a bit more detail. But can we just take it back to the absolute beginnings and look at perhaps the basis of some of these mental health issues you've had? Mm. If you wouldn't mind just talking a bit about your childhood?
Yeah, of course. So I've done a lot of work. So to grow through what I've grown through, and as we go through, I'll kind of go through the points. But you kind of have to, and a lot of that is to become aware of things and to find exceptions with those things. And I guess the first thing goes back, the earliest memory is from my childhood, and I had quite a loving relationship with my mother. She was my best friend, but also quite an unhealthy relationship with my mother, because I loved her so dearly, and she was my world, because I didn't really have much else other world. I was a young gay man in East London, living in a council estate with quite straight brothers that say loved football. I absolutely hated football. I was so rubbish at it. But I liked to dance and I loved to sing. And my mum brought me up on the most beautiful music, and it just, lyrics and music and things really moved me. And I later learned out that I was dyslexic. So I was a lot more creative as a child and less kind of like traditional masculine, kind of like we play football, we do this. Like, no, I'd rather sit in my room and listen to music, you know. So I was very different from a young age. And as I was growing up, my father, who I don't speak to, I haven't seen my father for 15 years, he would beat my mother, and he would do it so openly in front of us. And I have this very, very real reminder and memory from when I was about 7, and we was at something called a working man's club. So if any listeners know what a working man's club is, they'll know what a working man's club is.
Unfortunately, most of our listeners will not have any idea what a working man's club is. They'll might have seen a few films.
It's a traditional East London working man's club. It's where you used to go, like the local community used to go. You know, that was really where everyone in your local little town would go. And I lived near West Ham Football Ground. And yeah, so we'd all go, all the East Londoners, for cocking knees up. So, yeah, and I remember my mum and dad disappeared. And I walked out into the lobby. My mum looked really distressed. And my father had her up against the wall by the neck. And I remember just standing in front of him and trying to push him away, this little 7-year-old timid thing, while he's kind of going in on her. And it was, and in a public space, and it was very, yeah, that was the start of what I had seen, you know, a relationship to be, and also a loved one to be hurt so dearly. And like, I was such an empathetic, young, sensitive thing, and I still am. I'm just a little bit older now, and I think a little bit wiser, I hope. So, yeah, that's kind of where it started with my mum and dad, and watching her, and watching how that affected her. I'd be very observant to see how it affected her emotionally and mentally as well, and I kind of watched her deteriorate from that moment, I guess. That's where it started.
In terms of that relationship, then, your dad's moved away. I mean, so what happened? There was an abusive relationship, and then what happened?
So my dad was then having an affair, and he would go away for days at a time and leave my mother. And there would be situations where he'd leave without any money, and our electric would run out, and our gas would run out because it was all metered back then. And then he was having that affair, and then he finally left her. And then when he left her, that triggered her kind of start of her mental illnesses. And I was so young, I didn't quite understand it. And we got sent away, me and my two brothers. We must have been 8, 9 and about 5, I think. So I was 8 at the time. We got sent away to my auntie's very abruptly. And it was because my mum tried to commit suicide because she just couldn't cope with the fact that my dad had an affair and he'd decided to leave her for another woman. So, we went into care for my auntie for a good couple of months while my mum kind of pieced herself back together, and she got back on her feet. So that's kind of where it triggered her mental health issues. And yeah, that's really where it kind of mostly started.
To what extent was your mother somebody who was, which I think is unfortunately a very common issue, somebody who was totally in love with their abuser?
I think she was completely infatuated with my father, because if I look back and just from my observations of having the history and experience that I do now, she only knew my father. That was all she had to know. So she was just completely in love with the idea of him from the moment that she was probably old enough to be in love with somebody properly, you know, and not your kind of schoolboy or schoolgirl love. So that's all she knew. So she was completely, that was her life. He was her life, you know, and then the kids were her life. So that whole completely changed. So absolutely, yeah, completely in love with him, but probably to an unhealthy extent, I would now say.
During this, obviously, there was a tough time with these family issues as well. Your father firstly abusing your mother and then leaving. Was there anything else? Like you said, you grew up in a very traditional East London background, and you're a gay man. Was there some conflict there? Were people accepting of you, or was there problems with school and people not quite getting you?
Massive conflict. I was very misunderstood. I misunderstood myself. I kind of always thought I had this little, I like to describe it as this light about me, or this little bit of magic, but other people didn't really see it, and all they would see at a younger age is this young man who was quite camp, and liked to sing and liked to dance, and I was a bit of an outcast in school because I didn't conform, you know, and I didn't enjoy doing the usual kind of boyish things. So I was very much a loner in school. And then a result of that was to be quite extremely bullied all of my school life. I'd go and sit and eat lunch on my own. I did the proper sad, like, I look back and it's quite sad, but, you know, I'd make out that I had an errand to run. I'd be walking around the school just so I could look busy, because I didn't want anyone to see that I didn't have any friends, and that, you know, and I wasn't on my own. Or I'd go and sit in the the stairwell and eat my sandwich for my lunch. And it was very sad upbringing, actually. And I'm at peace with that now, and I found it, I'm cool with it, and I'm happy to acknowledge that it was sad because it no longer exists, and it actually just is a part of my history. But it was tough being an East London. I was like an East London girl and an East London boy's body, and that was really tough growing up in my school. I got mugged 3 times in my secondary school. I got beat up a few times. Yeah, it was tough times.
You've talked about not being understood and perhaps not being accepted because of your sexuality. If and when did you accept your own sexuality? Or accept yourself because of your sexuality?
A very interesting question. Do you know what? I'd probably say only the past year.
Oh. And yeah. How old are you now?
I'm now, currently it's 28, it's my birthday in a week. Hey.
When did you, if you did at all, officially, if you like, come out?
So I came out, I got kind of pushed out. It's quite a funny story. So I got pushed out when I was 16. I was dating, kind of hanging out with boys from 14 onwards. And then I met a guy called Ryan, who then went on to be my boyfriend for 4 years. He was a bit older than me. And his name was Jessica to my mum and my family. So my mum used to call me, be like, how's Jessica? I'd be like, yeah, she's great. She's so lovely. And then she said to me one night, so what are you doing tonight? And I was like, oh, I'm going down the snooker club with the boys. Just like, I said some random shit that my brothers would do. I'd never go to the snooker club. And I went to GAY, 16. I got a fake ID off the internet. I went to GAY at Astoria. And there was this guy that I was kind of spending some time with, should we say? And he was a flyer boy, and he was like, oh my god, it's so good to see you, it's so good to see that you're out and gay. And I'm like, yeah, I'm living my best life, blah blah blah. And then the next day my mum called me, and she was like, how was the snooker club? And I was like, oh yeah, it was great. And then in the middle of the conversation, she just dropped, did you enjoy GAY? And I was like, yeah, I had a wicked time. And I was like, shit. She was like, I think we need to talk. I was like, yeah, we do. I forgot that I gave my old phone to my mum that had all of the old little boys on the phone, and he had texted the phone to be like, so good to see you, GAY, so good to see that you are out, so nice to meet your boyfriend, right?
Oh, my goodness.
So my mum then took me for a Chinese, and we like, why my brothers sat on the table opposite us. It was the most awkward moment ever. And she was, I don't know why she was shocked. I said to her, how are you shocked? I'm a dancer, singer, like, I love Whitney Houston, like, me and you would sit up gossiping, you know, we've even had moments where we've sat on the step together and had a menthol cigarette gossiping away. I'm like, how did you not know that I was gay?
I wasn't repressing it.
Yeah, it was very much out to sea, and that was my conflicts in school, is that I just couldn't keep it in.
Yeah. How did your brothers take it?
Do you know what? They were really cool, actually. My older brother's a little bit more closed-minded than my younger brother. My little brother is just such a beautiful soul. He's got such an open... We kind of went and staggered from older to middle to younger. Like, and we've all got a bit more empathy and a bit more open-mindedness. I think I'm the milkman's son, really. Sorry, Mum, if you ever do listen to this, but I did ask her the other day. Am I the milkman's son? But they did respond really well. They didn't have much to say. They were like, oh, so you're gay then? And I'm like, yeah. But I think they knew, to be fair, like... You actually get informed properly, and it's like, okay, well, nothing really changes. I'm still the same gay little or big brother, you know, and I'm just not going to have a missus, but I will still have the same life as you guys, you know, so nothing really changes.
Yeah, it's not like you have to, like, apply for a passport or something, is it? Like,
no, exactly. Know? No. I did actually have to apply for a gay card to get into GAY. That's no lie. I just said GAY on it, so it was a gay card. You couldn't get in without it. I thought it was brilliant. So my brothers would take the piss out of me for having a gay card, like, before I actually had one. Then I got one, and it was like, this is just brilliant. I can take the piss out of you even more. Yeah.
That's amazing. That is amazing. A card-carrying gay man. Wonderful. So, just in terms of relationships, in one sentence, how would you say your relationships have been with other men? Or even one word?
I mean, abuse is a really hard word to use, but I'm struggling to find another word. Possibly this is my dyslexic disclaimer. So I'm struggling to find another word. I don't think it's quite as intense as the word abused, but not used is the right word either. But maybe I'll give it a little
exploited?
Bit.
Exploited? No.
Yeah, a little bit. So exploited would be a really good word, actually. I've always had this. I've always felt this energy that I've had, and it's a very different energy, and I think it's empathy and it's sensitivity, and I think it's a love, it's an abundance of positivity and love that I've always had since a young kid, and people have taken advantage of it completely. And I've always tend to end up with those more broken men that need a bit of light and a bit of love. But the risk with that comes that I'm easily influenced, or was, because I didn't know myself enough. And I got taken advantage of quite a lot. And that led me to some quite abusive places, but generally in the mental mind space, not necessarily aggressively, because I'll thump you back just as hard as you hit me.
Yeah.
But it's more mental abuse is that for me, one of the hardest forms of abuse that someone can experience. And it takes... what is the cure for that? You know, what is the tablet you take for that? You know, a bruised eye will recover and you can go through kind of traumatic therapy to get over the shock or whatever it is. But how that affects one's mental composition, like it's big. So yeah, maybe abusive is the quiet word to use then, you know, but just not in the physical sense.
Is there one relationship in particular?
That was probably three relationships. So do you want me to go three of them?
Just perhaps an overview, yeah.
So three of the main relationships were to do with drugs, and it was due to the drugs that these situations happened, be that the lighter ones, I guess the first two were, I say lighter, like it's light, but it's not, it still just can really affect somebody, so cheating on somebody. Because of drugs, and that kind of really affects your self-worth.
So when you say cheating because of drugs, what do you mean?
So getting high, and then because you're high, you make decisions that you wouldn't usually make with your kind of normal moral compass. You would, it's only because you've taken the drugs that you've led to do X. Or does that access a part of your brain that actually is really you, but that allows you just to be the real person that you are meant to be? You know, you're a bit of a mess, and that's cool if you're a bit of a mess.
Cheated on who?
The partner on me.
Okay, right.
Yeah. So I had that on two occasions, but I guess the third one, the main one, was I fell in love with somebody that was addicted to crystal meth, and I wasn't going to say those words on the podcast, but I've decided to say those words on the podcast, because it's every step along the way I release a little bit more power from it, and I take back a bit more power from it, and I'm going to take back a bit more power from it today. So
good stuff.
He was addicted to crystal meth, and we got together, and he my love and my light, and I don't say it from a place of ego, I say it from a place of just what I feel now, and I do have that, and I know it's one of the kind things that I have about my soul. That kind of masks his addiction and relationship to drugs, and he managed to keep it at bay for a good 3 months. And
sorry, what did he keep at bay?
The fact that he would use crystal meth so regularly.
Right,
so I had no idea.
Oh, right, okay.
And it took one experience for him that triggered a bit of a traumatic time, and he basically put me into a situation where he asked if we could use it, and I said absolutely not. Like this is my bottom line, you know, like I'll do some fucked up things in my life, and I'll make some really bad decisions, and, you know, I probably still do to this day. I'm okay with that. Life is about balance. I like to vibrate up and down the scale. he put me into a position, and he very much, the language he used is if you love me, you'll do it. And that was the part of me that wasn't the wisest, you know, and that abusive part ties back to my mother. And when you're so in love with somebody and they're your life more than you love yourself, you know, then I did it, and I realised it's because I didn't love myself at all in the slightest, but what I did have is my world revolved around him. So that abusive relationship, that love, everything was about him. So, you know, he say jump, and I say, all right, how high, how many times, you know, and I did it. It got me high first to do it, and that's where it started for me. A really dark, unexpected, unmanageable and imaginable chapter in my life that I never thought or expected to happen. And you hear these people say, oh, that won't happen to me, that blah, 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 blah. As my nan would say, bollocks. That was my nan's buzzword. Proper, like, Catherine Tate nan, she would, you know, and it's absolute bollocks. You never know what's going to happen to you, you know, and you should never say things are never, never, because you never know what you go through and your traumas and your triggers, and that was a very much a trauma trigger for me. So that was the key thing for me, that relationship.
Would you mind just telling us a little bit about this drug habit, would you say?
Yeah, I'd say, I don't use the word addiction. I guess we can do in the sense from the work that I've done. I was not addicted to the drug. I was addicted to the abuse. And the abuse wasn't physical, the abuse was mental. And in order to get close to my partner, we had to take the drug. And we couldn't really have sober sex or any type of real relations, or he really struggled to open up to me on an emotional level. And that's hard for somebody that has a lot of emotions, and I feel a lot of things. I like to talk a lot, and I like to talk about, you know, creative things. And when that pathway isn't there, but you love this person so dearly, because I could see he has that he was just on a completely bad path. So in order to get close to him, from that point onwards when we first did it, we kind of had to take drugs, and then by taking drugs, it would lead us to taking crystal meth. And for those who don't know, I guess, what crystal meth is, I should probably try and explain it the best way I can. For me, it's one of the most powerful drugs I could possibly imagine. I haven't taken all of them. I've taken a lot of them. I'm sure everyone has, you know, and people are not very honest about admitting stuff like that. But I'm very honest to admit, you know, that I still party and I still do things. And I'm a human being and I'm a real person. And that's the thing I'd always hold close to me. So it's the biggest rush that you could possibly imagine, and it's a very sexual intense rush as well. That's what people use it for, and it's quite common in the gay scene, and it's been quite detrimental to the gay kind of scene in society over the past few years. And you know, I've seen a lot of demises from people and a lot of deaths from people around me that I've known of. It completely changes your, for me, I would describe as your DNA makeup, the person that you are, and it makes you someone that you are not. I felt very much like a demon, very much like somebody that wasn't me. I felt disconnected. And I do things that I'm extremely not proud of, you know. I would, and you'd only go to that place because of that drug.
Can I ask what type of things you would do?
Just sexually, really, things, you know, or also disloyal things. I'm a very loyal person, not like Georgie kind of loyal from Love Island in 2018. I'm like properly loyal. So,
I don't quite get that reference.
Do you not know? Hopefully, it's a good reference, isn't it? Yeah. Hopefully, some of your listeners will.
So I'm assuming when you say disloyalty, you mean cheating?
Not necessarily. It's more disloyalty to myself, really, I think, would be the best way to describe it. So I would do things that are completely out of my character and that were more potentially in his character. Or maybe there wasn't in his character necessarily, but the drugs generated this new kind of character. So yeah, so it'd be, you know, having sex with people that I would never even think about having sex with, or putting myself in environments or parties or situations that I would never be seen in, I never would go to. But you go for two things. You go because the drugs made you this completely different person, and then you also go because your partner wants to go, and then you love your partner. So those two things together combined are quite a powerful thing. And then it's only when you really come round do you realise, like, shit, like, I've just done some intense stuff or some things that I would never really do. And some people might be like, oh, that's not intense, that's not bad. But for my moral compass and for me and for what's acceptable for me, like, these are things that I hated myself for, really.
Would you mind explaining a little bit about the chemsex culture and how prevalent it is in London?
I think it's huge, it's massive, and it's been a bit of a curse for me, but it's also been a bit of a blessing for me, because I've had to experience a lot over quite a number of years, and I've seen a lot, and a lot of the chemsex stuff has led to a lot of my heartache and a lot of my struggles around being cheated on, around emotional kind of disposition from guys, or, you know, self-worth or lack of any kind of worth. And then it kind of, you lose your inability to of your sexuality, you lose your confidence around your body, you lose your confidence around sex without a drug. And it's so hard to rehab back from that, and it's very much a journey that I've been on, and I'm very open and I'm very honest about it. And I worked fucking hard to come back from that. And I've seen a therapist 3 times a week. I've seen the leading chemsex therapist in London, and I'd meet him 2 times a week. And, you know, I'd always check in, and it's big. And I'd probably say, even now, the amount of times that sexually I get people step forward to me, chemsex versus normal sex. Probably about 70% chemsex kind of offers versus 30% normal. And that's sad that we live in a society. Maybe that's my friendship group. Maybe that's the platforms that I'm moving around with, you know, being a DJ and stuff as well. But yeah, that's quite sad. I'm like, no, I don't want to have sex with you high. I actually want to enjoy you sober.
See, that is, so this is probably, well, this is a blind spot for me. I'm quite ignorant about this because I had a sort of inkling that there was a thing, but I thought it was like major underground, like no. I just want to touch on the fact you said chem sex therapist. What specifically is it? Is that big of a thing that, first of all, there are specifically therapists for it?
Yeah.
And what's different about a chem sex therapist? Is it just because they're talking about issues that you've had through that?
So it's slightly different therapy. It's a part of every kind of gum clinic in London and beyond, and they have separate days. It's called chem sex groups, and they are trained therapists that usually have come through something similar like I've been through, and are able to tell the story and the tale, but also not only do that, but have the ability to help people and guide them and give them a bit of love and light around that. Okay, it's shit where you are right now, but here's how we can kind of rehab out of that in a sense. So they have like drop-in clinics where you can, and these people don't get paid hardly any money, and I think they have to volunteer as well, and they have my biggest utmost respect. And one guy in particular, his name is David Stewart, the most incredible man. He saved my life, and I can't thank him enough. He really has, you know, and I wouldn't have been as successful as I am today, not financially, just rewarding work-wise, as it wasn't without him and his time and his energy. So you go along for 20 minutes and you have an opportunity to talk to somebody. But just to get yourself to that position to go and talk, to say, hey, I have a bit of a chemsex problem. Wow, it takes a lot. And people are generally not that ready to do that. You know, you kind of put it to the side and you make out you haven't got a problem. But there are facilities available for people to go and have just a chat for 20 minutes.
Thanks. Why do you think chemsex is a practice that is so tied to gay culture? Is it just because gay culture is generally more underground and experimental?
Gays are mad. Not in the like mental sense, not in the literal sense, but like we're just wonderfully mad. We're beautiful, we're creative. Like, gay culture is just, it's an explosion of just like self-expression. And usually as a gay man, you know, we come from, we come from traumatic childhoods and that rich history of that, you know, of issues with being bullying or trying to find our place because society doesn't quite accept us. Things are changing now, and that's amazing for these new millennial kids coming through, and I'm so thankful for them, and I hope they don't necessarily have the same amount of struggles. But for those who are a little bit older, I kind of just hit into the brackets, but for those even more older, you know, you come from a traumatic time. That trauma manifests in many different ways. That manifestation can be self-worth or lack of self-worth. Lack of self-worth leads you to doing things that people with worth necessarily wouldn't do, because your bottom lines are a lot less than those with higher bottom lines. And I think that's where it is, and that's where the story is with gay men, and why we're so like crazy and, you know, bareback sex and all these kind of things. Like, it happens a lot. And where does it come from? We don't just wake up and go, oh, I want to go and get HIV. Like, we wake up because we have come trauma and we haven't accessed it and dealt with it, and it manifests itself in some ugly ways, unfortunately.
Brilliantly put.
Yeah, that was beautifully put. Mm. Talking of self-worth, I think this leads us very nicely onto hopefully what sounds like your kind of, I guess, rediscovery of, or discovery perhaps, of self-worth through being a gym instructor. Mm-hmm. Would you mind talking to us a bit about that, please?
Yeah, I guess I'll start with the tattoo that I've got on my arm, which I'm kind of showing the boys now. It's in Hebrew and it says to be kind to yourself. And I, one of the first kind of abusive relationships I had, he's now a friend of mine, and he knows he was a shit. Oh my god, he was an absolute shit. But I'm friends with him now because I like to give him some love and light, and I like to help him as well. And he's made his amends. Anyway, so I had a therapist from that, and he would say to me, "You're so hard on yourself. You need to be kind to yourself." So I got this tattoo on my arm, and it was an anchor and a reminder, a daily reminder. I got it, but I didn't get it for the right reasons. It's only now that I realise I have it for the right reasons, when I went through the most recent kind of really hard relationship. So I wasn't very kind to myself, but through the art of teaching, people were being kind to me, and on quite a big volume level, and it was very intense to me, and I didn't quite, it's very emotional, it's very like, wow, like, why are people being so lovely to me, like, am I actually a really good person, I knew I always had this light in me, but I never really understood it and accessed it, and through my teaching and my classes, it's allowed me to understand it, and it's allowed me to understand the impact that I can have on people through just being myself, and that's so special to know that I can grow through. I couldn't be myself necessarily when I was a child because no one respected and honored and you know, wanted to receive it. But now as an adult, I get to be myself, and I was just running around in Ibiza in a pair of high heels DJing for someone's birthday, and it was fabulous. And I get to express myself and be exactly who I am, and people appreciate and they vibe off that light and that energy. And that's, and this all came from starting from me teaching classes, you know, just that, like what you said at the start, that's why I said it was meant so much more to me than you realise, because it's for people like you and feedback like that that have allowed me to discover who I really am meant to be. But only, not only that, but be okay with it and find acceptance with the person that I am.
How and why gym?
How and why? Good question. Listen, I love fitness, but I'm not a big fitness person. Like, I've probably got the smallest biceps out of any of the trainers in gym box. I'm okay with that, huh? And the reason I'm okay with that is because it's not about the exercise. I don't care about the education necessarily about, you know, teach you about unilateral movements and blah, 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 blah. You can chuck the textbook at someone as much as you like, but that's not why I'm in fitness. I am in fitness because it changed my life. But not from a physical perspective, from a mental perspective. It made me a much happier person. And it made me, I stumbled across a Zumba class in Fitness First while I was working in PR and marketing. And I had this noise come from the studio and I was like, what on earth is that? So I was doing some boring exercise on the gym floor. I had no idea what I was doing. And I put my head around the corner and this woman was like, come in, please come in. Her name was Rachel. Yeah, she very much, she started my career in the fitness world, and she was like, come in, and I used to be a dancer and I loved it, and she was like, oh my God, your energy, you should be an instructor. And I went and did a Zumba qualification. I got £2,000 in my bank account, and I was working for the John Lewis Partnership at the time, and I left to go and teach Zumba classes, and my friends were like, what the fuck are you doing? Yeah. I got a part-time job on reception at Fitness First, paid me like £4 an hour. I had a lovely time talking to all the boys, because it was in Covent Garden, and all of the gay boys from London know me from working there, and they've seen me kind of grow, and yeah, that's where it started for me. And it wasn't a money thing, it was a fitness thing, because through fitness you can help people to feel good. And my motto now is, if I can leave you with something more than I found you with, so be that a smile, you know, a better day, a fitter body, just impart something more than you had, then that's me done. I'm blessed, I'm happy.
Great. So this final session that you gave, you referenced hitting rock bottom. It seems counterintuitive to say, but it's almost as though sometimes you need to hit the absolute bottom in order to turn your life around. I don't think, from regardless of what your answer to this is, that we're going to advocate people aiming for rock bottom in order to turn their lives around. But would you mind just reflecting on that a little bit, please?
So there's a coach for me who is a big part of my journey and chapter, and she once said something in a class, and it was, magic happens outside of your comfort zone. And it was during that class that I just really connected with this higher power, this higher thing, where I really experienced what that was. And I pushed myself far beyond my limits. And this was in to do with a fitness setting. And it really resonated with me. And it stuck with me for a while. But this was when I was going through kind of the crystal meth and the drug abuse and stuff. And I didn't quite really connect with it. And it wasn't until I hit my rock bottom where I wanted to take my own life, you know, I wanted to end it. I just couldn't see a way through. And thankfully, I've got the most beautiful people around me who had my back and could see that I was made of more or worth more than what I was doing or treating myself. And I became very uncomfortable very quickly, kind of rehabbing back out of it. And through therapies, I didn't do traditional rehab and stuff because I wasn't quite addicted to the drug. It was more the abuse and that relationship. So I was very uncomfortable for a very long time. And one thing that I learned through that those few years was that, you know what, magic really does happen outside of your comfort zone, and you got to get very comfortable with being uncomfortable, because once you do and you go through that, and it's usually that moment that's the loudest to you, that those voices telling you to give up or stop, that's usually the moment that you're about to succeed. And something will change, something will trigger. So, and it, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. And I remember it so clearly. And that was that waking up in a hospital bed and nearly losing my life. And my best mate sitting next to me. And it was just, I just could see it in his eyes. And I was like, wow, you know what? This is, I'm made of more than this. And I've hit my rock bottom. And I don't wish it on anybody. And we can find magic in so many other different ways. You can get uncomfortable in so many other ways. Just push yourself daily. Do something that challenges you, something that's a bit out of your comfort zone. This is out of my comfort zone, sharing this story. But by doing this, I know I'll hopefully help others or trigger something for them in a positive way. And I'll take stuff from this. So today, I'm getting out of my comfort zone and making a bit of magic happen. And it's how I preach, you know, it's how I practice stuff. And it's kept me on a very strict, clean path. And yeah, it's helped me to manage to build my life back and discover who James really was meant to be, and not the James that I was led to think that I was because of gay society or what gays wanted me to be. I'm now unapologetically me, and I make no exception. I'm very happy with that.
James, thank you so much. You've been an absolute star. Just the final, obviously this has been about you, but a big part of our podcast is hopefully trying to maybe, you know, share a bit of wisdom. And what would you say to someone who felt like they wanted to go to the gym, maybe get fit, maybe just clear their head a bit, but is slightly daunted by the prospect of not of going to the gym because they feel it's not for them?
I would say for them to think about, first of all, that thing, a thing that they first did the first time where they felt so nervous about, so anxious. Anything you did the first time was always the hardest. But then to think about that thing, and think about it when you did it a little bit more. How did you feel? Think about that thing again. And think about how did you do when you did it for a month? It's the same with fitness. Everything's the same. Anything you did the first time is always the hardest. And how boring would life be if everything was just easy, you know? But repetition and consistency becomes familiarity. Familiarity then becomes confidence. And then you grow through that. So the first step is to try. Get up, give it a go, try. And yes, it'll be uncomfortable. But again, what did I say a minute ago? You know, magic happens outside of your comfort zone. And maybe just a bit of magic will happen just from going in the gym. And you don't have to do a big session. Or if you feel too scared to go in the weights room, go and do a group exercise class. They were a powerful tool for me and they changed my life in many, many ways. So, you know, go and do a group X class and see if that's see what that does for you.
Next time you do one of your classes that Paddy's been raving about, I need to get down to them.
I would absolutely love that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on, James. It's been an absolute pleasure.